Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Today, let's talk about the chip shortage, cash flow, and what we can learn about the payments flow. An interview with Gert Silvest, who's VP of Network Products. This is a bonus episode of The Business of Tech. We've had a lot of discussion in the technology industry about the chip shortage, and the obvious impact is it's causing a bunch of delays. But do you think there's more impact of the shortage on the supply chain? Where's your head at on that?
Yeah, no, I think part of what is in this is probably classical bullwhip effect, and I think to some extent that's probably on everybody's mind. So one of the things that we see, for example, in our data across our network, and as you know, in TradeShift, we are connecting large enterprises with a supply chain. So we get a quite good view on the order flow and invoice flow. And one of the things that really became noticeable here during COVID was that after a certain while, actually the order flow started being like pre-COVID times again. And shortly thereafter, especially for the US, going way above pre-COVID levels. But what we could also see was that things like invoices still had, you know, additional longer tenors than pre-COVID, and that just simply the payment of invoices are lagging way behind the order. So I think everywhere you look in the supply chain, there's this kind of crank up of the economy coming and driving a large increased demand. But on the other side of that, you have a lot of companies that are now really challenged to meet this increased demand. And in classic bullwhip fashion, I think there's also the exaggerated demand for seeing trying to predict the uptick. And then you have companies that are strapped for resources. Maybe they have laid off employees, sent people home temporarily, ramped down production facilities, all of these things. I think that kind of contributes to perfect bullwhip scenarios.
So isn't it just a matter of it's been my experience, and obviously I spend a lot of time thinking about small companies. Large companies just tend to be slow payers. They hold on to their cash. Are you saying it's getting worse, or is this just symptomatic of what they normally do?
I think it's always a power struggle, right? So it's not a level playing field. If you are a strategic supplier to a large buyer, you have some leverage. If not, your leverage is poor, and that is of course being used by the large companies. But I think we've seen it both during COVID here and during previous financial crises, that the moment any kind of uncertainty or economic crisis hit, then automatically also the large buyers become more conservative on the cash flow. They are holding back. They are paying a little bit later. They are picking, you know, who are truly the strategic suppliers and who are maybe not. So I think there's always this kind of game going on. So it's definitely not a level playing field in that sense.
So in your data, do you have insight into the effect of distribution on this? You know, oftentimes, particularly for very small suppliers, if there are small purchasers, they'll leverage distribution in order to have them act as the bank or additionally help with that. Are you seeing impact of distribution on this?
Not too much. I would say in our network, you know, we have roughly 1.5 million companies. They are connected to very large, typically multinational enterprises. But we see the transaction flow within that network. So it's the true B2B flow. We don't typically see the business to consumer side or the end user. So how that is actually happening. But we do see other signals within the supply chain. Of course, we see, we definitely see large companies also during COVID that, that suddenly started thinking about, you know, the viability of their supply chain and how they could help protect their sellers. And that, that's both in economic terms. So for example, deploying early payments programs to sellers to protect them from immediate economic impact. Also on the government side, like what you saw with for example, the National Healthcare, which is the world's biggest buyer, is that they government help create policies for supplier payments to happen faster. So I think we've seen a lot of those initiatives anywhere in the world. But I think, to be honest, it also depends on what's the cash flow position of the buyers. So how hard are they hit themselves by the crisis? And how complex are their supply chains? So a very complex supply chain, you'd want to invest in protecting that.
One of the basic premises here of for smaller companies is to do their bit to address the inefficiencies in the system. What's the guidance that you generally give to companies to say these are the bits that you can control over this system?
The general picture we are looking into is that I think the whole e-commerce revolution is also driving an increased number of transactions between the businesses. So that's clearly, we are living in a world where still maybe 80% of the transactions are either paper-based or email-based. So that's fundamental inefficiency in just people typing in stuff, picking up the phone, asking, have you received my invoice? When will I get paid? And those kind of things. So I think there's definitely a trend towards both large and small companies kind of adopting the digital platforms and the digital networks. In Europe, you see, you know, government-backed open networks that are, you know, have no transaction costs. In the commercial space and where we also play as, you know, you see these e-invoicing and procurement networks. And of course, there are some efficiencies to be had there. But to be frank, I think often how it's viewed from smaller companies is that it's not something that drives their efficiency. It's typically an efficiency that benefits the large buyers in this equation. And if you think about it, like you've had EDI since 1970s, right? So people understood that paper in the supply chain is very wasteful and inefficient. But still up to this day, when you only see a 15 to 20% adoption of electronic, you know, transactions between companies, then clearly there's something wrong. And I think you're asking about kind of the crux of the matter. That is, when you digitize, the value of that digitization is often super unevenly distributed. So as a small company, if I have 30 different buyers, I may be asked to integrate to 30 different systems. And it's often not, you know, myself that gets the benefit of that digitization.
What's your thinking then on how we fix this? That's the obvious next question. How do you fix it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I actually think the recipe is out there already. And really that's, you know, is also what made me create Tradeshift together with my co-founders. There was this realization of why hasn't anybody done anything about this before? Because if you looked at the whole digitization industry around electronic invoicing, electronic purchase orders, it was very transactional based. So it was like, you know, what SMS was for the telco networks in the 90s. It was a big cash cow, and you made money just of moving these bits and bytes around, and every bit would have a price tag on it. And on the other hand, if you then looked into what happened actually on the e-commerce space, you see players like and financial Alibaba that are closely connected with the leading Chinese e-commerce sites. And they offer this kind of mixture of payment rails, financing rails, advertising rails that are integrated into the marketplace. So clearly where there's value be had for companies to participate in those kind of networks, that's access to market. It's access to finance. It's access to opportunity. It's, you know, benchmarking with competition. Those kind of things. It's not the raw efficiency of moving paper to digital. So to find out, how do we actually solve this problem? I think we have to go one or two levels above that and think about, when we digitize, how can we create equal value for those that participate? And I think that that requires us to go beyond efficiency and think about, you know, money, jobs, access to markets, selling more, these kind of things that matters for companies.
I'm going to ask a question, and it may be overly simplistic because I want to make sure that listeners understand what we're talking about. When you talk about digitizing the supply chain, it's much more than just the idea of the invoices are represented electronically. So, for example, I know every one of my listeners is probably going, well, I have all my stuff is digital. It's all in QuickBooks or in my professional services platform. Everything, of course, is digital. But can you help me define for those who may be a little bit more lay on this, like, what do you really mean when you say it is a digital version of that system?
Everybody you ask will probably give a different answer. In Germany, sending a digital PDF, for example, has been defined as digital invoicing. So you see, also in the statistics, you get very different numbers when you look at this. But the way I look at it is, it's in the collaboration. So when I have something that's digital, if I share that with a buyer, a seller, my bank, do they have to retype it? Is there, you know, opportunity for exceptions to creep in? Do we agree on what is an invoice or what is an invoice not? What should it contain? When we speak to our buyers, we typically hear that one in 10 invoice results in a phone call, which is just, have you received my invoice? Why wasn't it paid? And there are exceptions in these kind of invoices. In the T&L industry, it's more than 70% exception rates on invoices. So that's when you have an email or a PDF, you don't capture those kind of things. So I'm really talking about digitizing from source to kind of destination, from the seller to the buyer's accounting system.
So that's the key bit, is that that link from the seller to the buyer in both of their systems. So how would someone who's, you know, particularly in technology or that is looking at this, what are the questions they need to ask to understand if the systems they're looking at actually do that correctly?
One of the things that we are seeing today and for the past decades, that's definitely that everybody has their own siloed system, right? So if you look across Europe, you find more than 5,000 different accounting packages, and it's somewhat similar in the US. So I think one key question is, does the system actually allow for easy import export of standards and formats that are recognized in the industry, whether those are open standards like UBL, which is maybe more predominant in Europe, or things like CXML that have been defined in the industry. And do these systems support integration APIs? And I think a big question and that is also really whether those systems are cloud enabled or not, because it changes the whole economics of this. You can imagine for somebody having to integrate to legacy accounting systems that are installed on premise, you have to repeat that process again and again for thousands and thousands of customers. And when the accounting system starts to go into the cloud, it's a completely different economics of scale that can help actually enable those kind of buyer to seller integrations, or seller to bank integration, or buyer to funder integrations, or what have you.
Well, that integration work that you've just described is what most of my listeners are making their livings doing. So that's where I look at it and say, like, I always say, in mystery there is margin, in complexity there is this opportunity. Because it's a complex problem, there is an opportunity to do services here, but the trick is finding a way of systemizing that so that it is repeatable and executable. And that's where I think is where we're going. So is that the kind of solutions that you're working on, is making that a little bit more of a systemized process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we recognize that from day one, that, you know, you have a fundamental barrier there from, you know, when you get inside the company and you have to access the system. So We started by doing APIs. We started by then supporting all the open formats that we see in the industry, and also kind of industry proprietary formats to make it easy for people to share information. When we started investing in machine learning in 2013, it wasn't sexy decision making and second guessing the competition. It was really about using machine learning based approaches to convert images, PDFs of invoices and purchase orders to machine readable formats. Of course, connectors to common cloud accounting systems like QuickBooks and others. And today we are more and more investing in just standard connectors for also the large accounting system packages. And the latest, I would say, is machine learning supported integration. So conversion of formats. You can imagine if you've exchanged a document format between two pairs of accounting system for a long time, you become better at guessing which fields actually correspond to which fields in the different systems. So I think that's an area where there's huge potential in just reducing the manual labor in that.
Gotcha. So in the interest of leaving our listeners with something they can do, if someone who's listening here is a technology integrator, they're an IT services company, and they're saying, yes, I want to play more in the business layer, and this is something that I can help my customers with, what would you tell them the first thing they need to start working on learning is?
I think it would be a good place to start to actually familiarize themselves with the different kind of networks that are out there. Because I think it's true that most companies are connected into multiple networks if they have large buyers that require kind of digital exchange. They are, but I also think they have very different properties and different attractiveness. And typically what we see, for example, suppliers to large buyers is that they are very picky on where they want to invest their integration dollars, because sure, you're a large strategic buyer, you want to invest there. But what about the next 50 buyers that line up with similar requirements? So I think we are back to the question of what's the value of this? And I think the crucial thing is, what can you provide back? What can you give in return for that digitization? And I mean, from my perspective, things like access to early payments is a key thing. So one of the reasons why, for example, factoring has been so expensive always is because factors typically have very little insight into the transactions between sellers and buyers. That's something digitization can help with. So if you go and start integrating with buyers, I look for the open networks that actually help provide some of that value back to whoever integrates, and ensures that they can reach not just one buyer or one seller, but as many as possible through a single integration.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.